Good morning. My name's Tom Scott. I'm on a beautiful train bridge, no longer used. This is the Tennessee River, and it's the border between Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Florence, Alabama. Okay, and I'm joined as always with RP Eddie, by RP Eddie. Welcome, RP. Really, though, today, even though I'm Alabama, I'm just across the border. The Natchez Trace, which is this great drive, takes you in here. We got here last night. It really was Mississippi Day. We were in Mississippi all day. And it was an amazing day. Probably the most uplifting day of the trip. You know, really, we saw a lot, which I'll share. I'm going to share. So we've been on this journey. We went the course of the Mississippi. We did shows along the way. And now we're in, as I said, Alabama. And I talked about what a highlight Mississippi was yesterday. So I'm going to outline that and talk about Mississippi. Before we do that, there's two things I want to mention. One is that we have a dashboard today where we're just going to go through statistics and news, and we're going to use it as a way to continue to track ourselves as we go forward. That's number one. And then number two, RP and I spoke over the weekend and we said, hey, let's look at the 10 observations that we have to date over the course of these conversations and the course of what we've seen happening. So we're going to go through those today. He and I have not looked at each other. So there may be crossover, there may not be. We're going to do this as an exercise. And what we decided is, you know, as we see things that we want to go deeper on, we'll go deeper. But today will be relatively surface as it relates to that.
What's interesting about this, right? So remember, it's important everyone just kind of just remembers this disease does not live endemically. It's not part of our natural habitat. It's not in the trees. It's not in the dogs. It's not in the apples, right? It's in people. And so the whole reason we're flattening the curve is to get the disease out of people. A lot of people, for example, in New York had the virus, you know, a certain percentage died. A much larger percentage, thank God, survived. Either way, the virus leaves those people. And then it leaves the environment. And it leaves the ability to infect you and me. So right now, we've paid a cost to reduce the amount of virus effectively floating around in our fellow citizens. That's what we've done through this flattening the curve process. So now we reemerge. And we reemerge into a safer environment. There's less virus floating around, ideally, if we do this right, than there was before. And in some parts of the country, there's very, very little of the virus floating around. There's some counties in America with, you know, well less than 100 cases, sometimes one or zero. That means it's not floating around in people unless there's travel. Welcome to America. There's travel. Welcome to the summer. There's travel. Welcome to a country where people are probably not going to use the planes this summer as much, and they're going to probably do a lot more cars. So you might see a lot. I mean, we talked about this 2 months ago. We might start to see a lot of spread of this disease along highways as people drive across the country and sort of do what Tom's doing. So that's where we enter. Every model right now, including the one the White House favors, which you can presume is a very optimistic model, including my model, our model at Ergo, says we're a little more than halfway done with the deaths we'll get before August 1st. It's a horrible piece of news. There's probably 150,000 total U.S. deaths before this is over. At least we think higher. The White House model says 150. We think a bit higher. And those are people that are, some are infected now and some that are going to be infected as we do this reopening. So how do we reduce that? You know, hand washing, social distancing, mask wearing. In the reverse order, mask wearing, social distancing, hand washing. So that's what's coming. And all those people who are going to die between now and August 1st are gonna largely be because they're gonna get exposed as we reopen. So as much as we can minimize that, the lower those numbers go.
Yeah.
Not great news, but a reality.
Yep, well, and helpful information at a minimum. Let me highlight Mississippi really quickly because I'm going to talk about Mississippi in a moment. There's 11,000, just north of 11,000 confirmed cases there with 510 deaths. Mississippi's kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of like percentage infected, et cetera. You know, it's near the bottom of the country as it relates to healthcare, education, economic economy and infrastructure. So, you know, on paper, it has its challenges. They just reopened and retail stores are open. Food and drink is open. We went to, what's it called? Cracker Barrel last night. And they just had takeout. And it was quite safe. Like the way it was managed was really good. State parks and gyms are open. Personal care salons, et cetera, are open. Opening soon, entertainment, think casinos. There's casinos here and other things. But that's just a snapshot on Mississippi. We'll give snapshots as part of this this dashboard over time. Just thought it would make sense to do Mississippi today. And look, I can't be so scientific because this trip has been, you know, only 2 weeks so far. And but I would say our best observation is that Mississippi seems to be pretty responsible as it relates to number of masks we see, the places that we've gone into. We visited Eastern Mississippi Community College yesterday. If you've ever seen Last Chance U on Netflix, we were at that school. That school was appropriately shut down. And, you know, and that seems to be true kind of across the state. So I want to keep today's dashboard relatively tight because we got a lot to get to. ARP, if there's anything you want to comment on there before we go, I just want to go just quickly through my experience in Mississippi yesterday.
So everything, other than the Muscle Shoals comments, everything we've just discussed in the last few minutes has been very negative. There's some very positive news today. We could do it. I don't know how you want to splice this in. The Moderna vaccine trial. So Moderna is, you know, very large vaccine manufacturer, very large pharma company. They have been working, they're one of 100 efforts trying to build a vaccine. They published yesterday, I think, or certainly no later than Friday, no earlier than Friday, that they have had, in their initial phase trial, they've had a safety response and an efficacy response in humans with their vaccine. So there's lots of stages to go through to get large-scale efficacy, large-scale safety. This was the initial dosing safety trial out of three phases. And it was positive. Really, like, that's great, great news. This is called an mRNA vaccine, which is a new type of vaccine, never used before. You recall Lori Garrett mentioning last week, our Cassandra from our book, one of the great scientific minds of our day, that mRNA vaccines have never been used before, and we have to be very careful about safety. So there's a lot more testing necessary, but like great news, one of the great vaccine companies with a big initiative has already had positive results with their vaccine. So that's super good news.
NRP, when you go through that first phase, is it like a pass fail situation?
Yes.
Is there better? And so
there's lots of pass fails. There's lots of like, you're out, there's a lot of vetoes in these tests, right? So obviously there's safety trials, efficacy trials, then larger scale safety and efficacy. There's dosing trials. What's the dose needed to be? The good news on this Moderna trial was the initial dosing test. How much of the vaccine do you need to be effective? Showed that the lower doses worked. And that's great for two reasons. One is they can distribute more if a lower dose is needed. And two, you generally have a lower side effect profile as you have lower doses.
Mm. Okay, that is good news. So hope there. I'm gonna transition. You ready to roll?
Let's do it.
Okay, so three names I'm going to mention. One is Amanda Miller. Amanda Miller is somebody who watches us each day, and RP, and she wrote me and asked why Mississippi got no mention on the trip down the Mississippi. Now, we did do a story from Vicksburg, but I guess we weren't talking much about Mississippi at the time. But we did do a show from Mississippi. But then we went into New Orleans, you know, Louisiana, all the way to the Gulf. And then when we left New Orleans, we came up through Mississippi. It was a day of Mississippi. And so Amanda, this one's for you. We did take a good look at Mississippi, and I want to talk a bit about Mississippi. The other one is Freddie Camelier, who I mentioned before. I was in, you know, it was fun to go back and forth with Freddie last night. I saw Freddie Camelier on July the 6th in Boulder, Colorado. We were both at the Grateful Dead, our Dead and Company last show of the season. And I bumped into him there, but this is someone I've known my whole life. played football together. And he made Muscle Shoals. So when I was back and forth with him last night, just talking about our trip and what we had seen, and he's setting us up with some things we're going to do today as we travel around here. And as was mentioned, this is a, you know, incredible music has was made in this town and at this one location. And you mentioned the Swampers, the Allman Brothers were Swampers, you know, different, the people who came out of that, the story's just amazing. The other one I want to mention is Larry Gordon. If you came to TNP, I'm going to say it was 3 or 4 years ago. Larry Gordon, I think he was born in 35, 36, something like that. He's right around the same age as my father. And he's from Yazoo, Mississippi. And he knew Elvis. He went on to become Aaron Spelling's driver in California. And he made, you know, Smokey and the Bandit. He made Field of Dreams, Boogie Nights. I mean, movies you can't believe. What's the one, Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Effer? What's that one called?
With Bruce Willis.
The Tower, that one.
Die Hard?
Die Hard. He made all those movies. Anyway, big movie producer and just the nicest guy and a great storyteller. He was another guy I was in touch with as we were coming through Mississippi yesterday. And again, you know, people from Mississippi seem to have a real fondness for where they're from. And most of us, and I'm talking about us Northeasterners, we just think bad things about Mississippi. You know, we think racism and you know, bottom of the food chain as it relates to education and income and all these other things. And I, you know, I say we, that's unfair. Some people do. It seems to be the reputation. And I know that when we came in here, Joe, who I'm traveling with, he mentioned it too. And it is generally treated in some ways as a stepchild. And that was Amanda's point when she wrote yesterday. But I got to tell you, it was just such a day. It was such a day. It was, you know, the people were so nice and they were so optimistic. Again, I'm not trying to be scientific here, but for what it's worth, when we see anyone, we start in. I mean, we want to hear a few things like, you know, what has them upset? What has them hopeful? You know, where do they stand politically and how much are politics a part of the way they navigate this whole process? The balanced nature of the people we spoke to. You know, we talked about racism with people. We were with a family at the birthplace of Elvis yesterday. And this, you guys should run this picture, but this is the home that Elvis was born in that was built by his father. And when we got there, it was closed. It was just Joe and I and a black family from Alabama. And so we talked and we got into all these different questions. And we talked about racism. And they love the people around here. People time and again would identify there's a few bad ones out there. They'd kind of say it that way. But just the tenor in the way they reacted was so powerful to me. It was very, very matter of fact and very hopeful. And again, everyone's so friendly to us when we speak to them. When we went through Tupelo, that's where Elvis was born. We were in Tupelo and we were outside a bar and they had like a gathering because now they can go outside again. And they were all outside. They were all relatively far away from each other. They did a crawfish boil. And it was a mix of black people and white people all hanging out together. Again, unscientific. I mean, this isn't a massive sample set, but very hopeful. We stopped. We talked to them socially distanced, wearing a mask. You know, they've been challenged, but they weren't bitter. You know, they weren't bitter. And then we saw that time and again, kind of throughout the trip and, you know, Tupelo, what a place. And yes, we cranked Tupelo Honey. I probably hit replay 15 times as we were coming through. I'm not kidding. Joe was like, is he going to do it again? And I did it again. Anyway, it was just such an uplifting day. We did a big workout at Eastern Mississippi Community College, which is again, is the school from, Last Chance U. And again, we run into people, and again, everyone was really nice to us. And here's what I would say. Here's the top line. The top line is that they feel like they have been through a big challenge. They have some level of fear, but their general tenor seems to be really one of optimism and not one of blame. And they also, you know, I think one of the things about the way we think near where we live, RP, and say coastal places, we think nationally about just about everything. You know, everything's national. not that that's a bad thing, but here they really think about their own communities. I mean, they're really of their communities, and this is their life and their place. And some of the questions I'd ask, you know, they think like, I don't know, I don't pay any attention to that. You know, they don't pay attention to a lot of the squabbles and the different things that we get into. So I wanted just to tell that Mississippi story because it was very hopeful. And it made me realize, and you've heard me say this before, and it just proves itself time and again. You know, Twitter is a lie. I keep saying that. I believe that. The tenor of Twitter, the message of Twitter, is not what you see in reality. And of course, I'm generalizing. You know, when we first came into the state, we were pulled over at a roadblock. And the roads look exactly like they look from Mississippi Burning, tree-lined roads that wind up and down. We never do interstates. We're always on the back roads. And so we were a little anxious. And after we went by, Joe, who I'm traveling with, he said it. He's like, that was scary. I was like, I was a little scared too. And the long story short is that the Mississippi brand is unfair. The Mississippi brand, as I perceive it in quarters like ours, it's unfair and it is wrong. Now, a lot of people from Mississippi would say the same thing. And I don't know exactly what I mean specifically when you get down to the data, but I know what I mean when I say tenor. I know what I mean to say the way we are treated. I know the way that I observe they treat each other. You know, this isn't my first time to Mississippi, but it's the first time I'd been in a while, and there was something really striking about it. So that's my ode to Mississippi yesterday. As I mentioned, I crossed the border. Now I'm in Alabama. And we'll tour around Muscle Shoals today and see what's happening here. But that's my update on that. I don't know if you have anything you want to talk about as it relates to Mississippi RP.
No, I think there's probably, I think the Mississippi brand historically back in the 60s was probably well-deserved. But there's probably been a tremendous number of angels and civil servants and, you know, race workers and others that have changed the state to what you're seeing now. It was probably a very hard fought, in some ways bloody evolution.
Yeah, and that's very fair. To the best of my knowledge, that's a very fair assessment. And I think the bottom line is, like, our blanket statements, and I know I'm making them, and I'm walking a fine line here. We got to be careful about those. Yeah. Right? I mean, blanket statements are, you're in dangerous territory every time you kind of do that. So.
I like your point national versus local focus as well. I think that's really fascinating. I spend my life, right, since college has been global or national focus. It's just where I've worked, where I've been paid. And this pandemic really makes you look at county by county numbers and family by family stories, local. We used to say, ironically, when I worked for Dick Clark at the NSC, the office was called Global Issues and Multilateral Affairs, big government title, right? And the title was was the opposite, right? Think local, act global. Whereas, you know, the bumper sticker says think global, act local. We did it backwards.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, when I started Nantucket Nectars, when Tom and I started Nantucket Nectars, the goal was to be in 24 accounts on Nantucket. That was the goal. Now, we were young, we were naive, and about a year and a half later, it was to be in 72 accounts on the Cape. But never we're going to be in every state. I don't think anyone starts a business today thinking that way. Now, and by the way, we weren't the norm. Everything wasn't national, national, national. Nowadays, everything's going to be everywhere, and not that there's necessarily something so wrong with that per se, but I think there's also something to, you know, nuance and the granular nature of where you are and the appreciation for the people around you. Because in a certain way, if you remember that photo I showed of End America, it's an arbitrary set of lines, generally speaking. I mean, you know, that are us 330 people set between these two states that are far away and the 48 that are all next to each other. You know, it can be thought of in so many different ways. And I think it's healthy to think of it in those ways. And I should add, you know, you read the story of Babel. It's hard for 330 million people to be one thing. I mean, that's just a really hard thing to even consider. Let alone to be part of 10 million people being one thing. So it's just such an interesting moment in that way. And the internet really taught us that everything is everywhere at all times. And yeah, in a certain sense, that's true. But there's another side of that equation that I think we've lost a little bit. And as you journey back into it, it can feel really good. So
I think it's, we're not going to do it now, but I think it's really worth unpacking the value of understanding that 330 million people in one country should share some things. We should aspire to share some things, but we probably have to let ourselves off the hook of being some blended homogeneity because we're not.
Right. That's right. Okay. So RP, I am totally open to the format you want to do this in. So I have my 10 observations. RP has his. We could do one-on-one and go all the way through. What do you think?
I ordered mine. We could try to do one. We probably should try to do one-on-one, and then because we're going to have a lot of overlap. So my order is like the reality, what seem like smart steps now and big lessons, sort of from near term to long term. For example, that's how I ordered mine. We haven't seen each other's lists. Why don't you kick it off with your first one, and then I'll see if it matches one of mine or if it's new.
Sure, and it'll be interesting to see sort of the scope of each of our statements, but let's see. So I'll start mine. My first one is, our next move will be about choosing which risks and which casualties to endure. This is my first one.
Yeah, that lines up with my second one, which is sort of, there is no easy way out, right? So it sounds like you're saying we are, you know, we're going to take some casualties. We have to just choose where they're going to be. And I, what I said was, this will not be a win-lose. This is a lose-lose. And I think that it's a tragedy. We have to do all we can to lessen the blow, but the punches are going to land, but it's going to end. So I guess my addition to your point was the Stockdale paradox, which I think we've talked about. That we have to accept the hard reality of the difficulty. If we don't accept that, we'll go crazy. If we think it's going to be over tomorrow. If you listen to the vaccine news we discussed 15 minutes ago and you say it's all going to be over by fall, you'll drive yourself bonkers. Do you want me to do one now?
Sure, go.
So the first one on my list is one of the first things we talked about, which is that our body and our brain both are flummoxed by this virus, right? The virus can kill our body just as it outlaps our brain. The panic of living in a viral pandemic overloads our rational brain and makes us very reactive. Our monkey brains rule right now. Our limbic brains rule right now. And that leads us to be stupid, to reduce our circle of empathy, and to be panicked, right? So my first assessment of this whole thing is, our bodies can be killed by this, and our brains can be fooled by something that they're not designed to understand, right? So this is viral growth, as we talked about, the saber-toothed tiger. So this panic makes us reactive, monkey-brained, limbic, and not proactive, not other-centered. So the initial response to this virus by all of us is not the way we want to think of ourselves. And I think if we just acknowledge that, that's a powerful start.
You know, I do morning routines each day, and I journal. Reading that each day would be very helpful to me. I think it'd be helpful to a lot of people. I think just to prepare yourself for the day, because each day sort of carries these things, and you know, we can lose our centers and therefore abilities to see as quickly or as clearly as we need to. All right, I'll go to my second one. Protecting the vulnerable is the man on the moon. So protecting the vulnerable is really our moonshot here. We've got to make that a clear position, an executable position, and we're going to have to do difficult things, almost unthinkable things. Unthinkable in the sense that it's hard to imagine what we may have to do it well. But I think the man on the moon analogy is not so bad.
I think that's great. So that that has been... I think as you and I have learned more and more about this, the policy solution that makes the most sense to me is that one, right? Obviously, wear the mask, find the vaccine, do the MPIs, everything we're doing. But I don't know why we haven't seen more attention to protecting the vulnerable, because they are 20 to 300 times more likely to die, the vulnerable, than people under 55, right? So there are ages of people and there are people with medical conditions that are hundreds of times more likely to die than some young, healthy people. So that is a must-do thing, I agree. And it kind of correlates with my, so we don't have a 20, I'll correlate it to one of my 10, which is we're not all in this together. We're not all in this together, right? This is crushing the communities that traditionally are left behind. That's no surprise. Well, it shouldn't be a surprise. The communities in this country that traditionally have the crappiest access to food and healthcare, that are underrepresented, underserved, are the ones who A, are dying at much higher rates than others. African-Americans, the elderly are dying, the poor are dying at much higher rates than others. Part of that's because of how they entered this disease, less health. And part of it is there may even be a genetic basis to this disease to select some of them, but we're not all in this together.
Okay.
Well, those are bad news ones.
Yeah. And I have, yeah, well, I mean, protecting the vulnerable is a man on the moon. I think it's something to shoot at, but anyway, and well, again, reality, and this actually, okay, so here you go. You just kind of walked into it. Trustworthiness and courage are required from those who point the way out. The trustworthiness side of that, I hope that one is self-evident. The courage one, I so believe that for many leaders right now, a lot of people don't like that word leaders. I understand where they're coming from to a certain extent, but what I'm trying to say is that people of authority in certain places, whatever those places may be, they will not get the rousing set of applause when they point the way out. They are going to deal with sniping and challenges and problems and unknowns in a way that maybe many of them have not in their entire careers. So that courage part, like trustworthiness, I hope goes without saying. Courage, though, they kind of need it more than ever.
I like that. Yeah, we're tracking. I said a very similar thing. The leadership vacuum is being filled with poison.
So, say it again. I missed that at the end. Is being
the leaders, the leadership vacuum. We have a leadership vacuum.
Yeah.
It's being filled with poison. And so it's two sides of, I think what you is the other side of what you were saying, right? So people with trustworthiness, which is a great word, it means a lot, and courage, you know, should sort of come forth and lead us, but they're not. So that vacuum, that leadership vacuum, is being filled by poison, right?
Yeah.
So that I mentioned before about our monkey brain panic, our reactive limbic response to this. You marry that up with a lack of leadership, a leadership vacuum, and you end up with a situation where we are probably unnecessarily dividing ourselves. And we are being divided by nefarious actors, right?
Yeah.
So there's a spectrum on one end of the irresponsibly incurious, as Nick Christakis put it, so that was a great word, the irresponsibly incurious. I wouldn't say that's an evil behavior. You're just irresponsibly incurious. You're the governor of Georgia who says, oh, I just learned this disease can be asymptomatic for a while the CDC is in a state. If you remember that about 4 weeks ago, that was irresponsibly incurious. Then you get to the clickbait media filling this vacuum for selfish purposes. Then you get to greedy politicians doing what greedy politicians do. Then you get to ridiculous conspiracy theorists. Bill Gates is not Mr. Burns. What's 5G trying to do to us? And then you get to downright enemies of the state, China and Russia, stoking the figures. Misinformation is knocking at the door, trying to separate us. So those two things, lack of trustworthy, highly courageous leaders and the inherent panic of a pandemic, are opening the door to these divisive groups, some which are semi-innocent and some which are downright evil, trying to pull us apart.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Is it my turn?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. The people who know the way out will likely not be the people who knew we'd pass this way in. I'm kind of reflecting on our show on, I don't know what day that was, Thursday. Problem pointer outers are not always the best solution leaders. I actually think you could, you are one guy I know who I think could sit on both sides of this equation. But I think, you know, look, the knowledge needed for the way out is so vast, and the knowledge needed in the way in was so specific, right? So Lori's knowledge is really specific. We need more general knowledge on in terms of how to get out, because the factors that you start to throw in there, economy, sociology, you know, some of the other unintended, well, that's the wrong word, but unlikely outcomes from this disease create a real issue. Were you looking for something in the book there?
I found it.
Go.
So that I have a very similar point, which is my last point, which is effectively it has to do with Cassandras, right? So Lori Garrett, who we had on the show a couple of days ago, our Cassandra from our book, someone that for over 20 years has been whispering in my ear and guiding me and my bosses more than me, and has never been wrong as relates to the disease. She's a two-time Cassandra, which is, I've never heard of it before, has a new set of warnings, and we had her on, and I suspect you and I both finished that call feeling pretty down, right? I mean, she's still, we all should be pessimistic, but she's really pessimistic about what's going to happen here, the way out. And warnings like hers need to be married with kind of broad, agile leaders who can help guide us out. So what I was just looking up was the name of Dr. Jim Hansen, who was another Cassandra, Cassandra about climate change. And Jim Hansen, I've had the real pleasure of meeting, and I don't think he'd mind me saying that Jim Hansen is a brilliant scientist, kind of the father of climate change science. And he's been proven correct over and over and over again. His science, one of his papers on climate change from the 80s has been considered the most scientifically accurate and prophetic scientific paper written, you know, since 1950. Like, the guy is good at science. He's really good at predicting where climate change was headed. And he was really early, Cassandra. He's a poor communicator to groups. And I think he'd acknowledge that. He and I were doing some speaking together. He's not, once you get to an N of people beyond 5 or 10, that's not where he wants to be. He's much better talking a smaller group. So Jim Hansen had to marry up with one of the, you know, great showmen, Al Gore. And that created the inconvenient truth from participant media, Jeff Skoll and other things pushing this story out. So you need to get the Cassandra with the broad communicator. I know a lot of people listening to this may not love Al Gore, and they probably don't know who Jim Hansen is, but the point is the marriage of the Cassandra, the warner, the deep technical expert with the communicator is very, very powerful. So my relevant lesson to my list, Tom, and so far it's call and receive here, which we're, you know, one of my big lessons at the end here is, will we learn to discern and listen to Cassandras like Lori, or will we prove Hegel correct with his quote that we learn from history that we do not learn from history? So my last lesson from this, kind of the Adam Robinson lesson, our conversation about being stupid or not, my last lesson, or my big hope, I have two big hopes, that's one of them, is that we learn to listen and discern Cassandras. We learn how to hear warnings. And let me do a really quick point here. Really interesting article yesterday or Saturday in the New York Times about why are countries led by women doing so much better in this pandemic than others? New Zealand and Germany are both completely outclassing other nations as compared to how they're doing with the pandemic. And part of the argument in this article, though of course both led by women, and what I mean, they're, you know, Germany is crushing everybody. Germany's performance on this is dramatically better than anyone else relative in Europe to scale, right? They're doing an extraordinary job. Likewise, New Zealand, both led by women. Why is that the case? And part of what the article theorized was that women don't have to be the brash, swaggering men who, like, I know the answer. I don't have to listen to people. I have to portray strength at all times. So here's the answer. Women don't take the ego shot, the ego weakening, by saying, I want to hear other points of view. They don't have to be the strong alpha. At least this is a cultural approximation, right? This is probably dangerous territory. I'm just reporting what the article said. So I thought that was fascinating, that women are willing to listen to other points of view to be more inclusive. Inclusion is what the Cassandra theory is about. I thought that was kind of cool.
You know, I once read a story about nuclear power and how women reacted to it versus the way men reacted to it. And I remember very early on, we were having a conversation internally about sort of the feminine and masculine reaction to this. Neither one of us are women, obviously. And, you know, my knowledge in this area is relatively limited, but I think it's just a really interesting conversation. I'm going to read that article. Moving on.
It mentions Van Halen, so they spice it up a little bit. It's not that bland.
It mentions what?
Van Halen.
Oh.
So to encourage people to read the article, it talks about Van Halen and the brown M&Ms.
Interesting.
Yep.
Okay, is it me or you?
That's you. We're doing call and respond, like a field holler, the roots of American blues.
All right, here we go. My trip has taught me that wisdom is derived from listening. The lessons are in the granular and not on Twitter or in elite knowledge centers. It's a big statement. I believe it. Listening has really been, I know this some percentage of the time. And then I get, like Kristen and I were talking before the show, you know, I get full of myself and all of a sudden I know everything. And then I calm down and I'm like, I don't know anything. But listening has been really powerful. And the truth is its own truth. I mean, just what I'm trying to say is it's tough to read this anywhere. It's especially tough to read or watch something on the news that accurately reports what's actually going on. And the brilliance is in listening. So.
I sign up to that. I don't have a field holler response exactly to that, but I began journaling today for the first time since 2017. Funny you mentioned it earlier. And I'm doing this daily stoic journal by my friend Ryan Holiday, which I couldn't recommend more fully to anybody. And Ryan Holiday is an extraordinary guy, by the way. We should have him on the show. But he put together this thing called the Daily Stoic Journal. And the thing I was working on today were, what are sources of unsteadiness in your life? And one thing that I was circling around is ego. It's a destabilizing force in my life. And the vaccine to ego, one of them might be listening.
Yeah. Where are we? Am I doing one again?
Yep.
Okay. You know, I'm just going to mention before I do. So yesterday I journaled long. We were driving and I read aloud to Joe along the way. It's so valuable. It's so centering. So clarifying. I just so recommend journaling. I know to a lot of people it sounds like a pain in the neck. I just so recommend journaling. The system being broken is not the issue. You hear it a lot. The system is broken. The system is broken. Culture being broken is where our problems lie. I think we have a cultural problem that is bigger than a system problem. In fact, the system will reflect the culture. And I think it starts with clickbaity information that divides us. I know I keep saying this. I think it's such a big issue. And the truth is, I'll use the word, I think we actually love each other. I really believe that. And I think if we knew how to love each other, and I think we do, it's in our instinct. If you practice, the system will follow. The system is nothing more than an expression of the culture. And I think we have a cultural problem way more than a system problem. And if you wait for the system problem, I just don't think that's going to be the way out.
Ah, that's beautiful. I think, yeah, sure. And did the Trump election and a lot of what we see the angry manifestations of behaviors, what I would call angry manifestations of behaviors we're seeing now in response to like mask wearing and the virus and other things, which look like these huge cultural divides, they are large cultural divides. I think they are representations of entire groups of people feeling left behind, ignored, and unloved. I think there's huge categories of people in this country who think the system is rigged against them, and they have lots of evidence that they're right. And perhaps what we've learned from some of our conversations with Stacy and others is the African American community looks at the fact that this virus is killing them way disproportionately, and they say, that's no surprise. The system's been rigged against us for a long time. And maybe the people who storm the courthouse steps in Michigan wearing tactical battle gear feel the system's rigged against their way of life too, and they're not being heard and they're not being loved. Although I give that last group way less credit, in fact, zero credit, but they must feel some degree of being marginalized too, to take up that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, we had that one incident where we saw people who sort of fit those characteristics, but meaning the more militant side. But I think that the when you hear the stories of sort of the right wing, red, Midwestern people who we've come across, and again, I'm generalizing, it's absolutely the way they see it. They see themselves as being victims of a system that's broken, and they see it around them. I mean, it's part of their lives. There's a definite similarity there.
So my corollary, my comment on our list might be really similar. Forgive others and forgive yourself for being panicked and confused and angry and viscerally afraid of others right now. Forgive yourself for feeling that, and forgive others for feeling that, and recognize that fear and panic, remember, as Vivek, the former Surgeon General, was telling us, that fear and panic is as mentally isolating as the physical quarantine, right? So to be terrified of other people and panicked by the disease is isolating, just as isolating as having to lock yourself at home. And so if we forgive ourselves and forgive others for being that panicked and confused and angry, and forgive ourselves for being thereby highly susceptible to the fake news peddlers and the others who are trying to divide us right now, and realize that we are susceptible to that. So I'm mixing a couple of things there, but I think that builds off of yours a bit. So that's taking your point, and I would add the concept of like accept it and forgive it.
You know, emotionally, I don't know many people who aren't somewhat roller coaster like in their emotions and their sense of their center. I know I'm not. It's nice to know the inputs that make people feel that way. And if you know that those are present, you can be more understanding with people, more helpful to people, more helpful to yourself. Okay. Well, this is a follow on from before, and there's a lot of repeat. So this one we don't need to spend time on because you've heard me on this one. But after I wrote my last one, the culture being broken is where the bigger problem lies. And yet, most Americans on the left and right flanks love each other. Our media, and I put in parentheses, and disinformation powers. And let me read that again. Our media and disinformation powers and puzzles tell them otherwise. Twitter is a lie. So let's just, Twitter is a lie is my statement there, and that people love each other more than they think.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think, you know, the leadership vacuum is being filled with poison. Twitter's fucking horrible. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know why I go to it. I go to it once. It is a good way to get a lot of really acerbic points of view fast, if you want that. Right? So if you want a bunch of people to spit in your face, it's a good way to get it, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the thing people say, it's like media people say, well, we use it all the time in media. It's like, yeah, no shit. It shows, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I wish they didn't. It's a good tool for them. I say it might be a bad tool. It might be the opposite.
And the vitriol bleeds into Facebook. I mean, there's this whole social media question about, like, why does my 14-year-old love Snapchat? There's none of this there, right? Snapchat is just like goofy little pictures of kids looking at each other. Instagram is supposed to be happy pictures of all of you just enjoying each other. There's all the problem about FOMO, fear of missing out on Snapchat, Instagram. And then Facebook is now turning into this place where I'm having this raging debate with an old eighth grade friend of mine. I'm about to cut him off, but you know, he's looking at you, Will. I'm about to be done with him, but he, you know, there, it is getting a little more angry inside Facebook, and then Twitter, forget it.
Go ahead.
So then let's talk about the way out. That's sort of what you were. So what do we need to do now? So one lesson, and I think it ties into a lot of the things we learned here. And it, look, very frankly, it probably turns in this lesson. We all know it. It turns into a greater society with or without a pandemic, right? We all need to be leaders right now, right? There's a leadership vacuum. And we need to fill that leadership vacuum individually. And you have to lead for your own personal safety. So I think we live in a culture where we know that statistically 98% of people don't make up their own decisions. They make up their own mind. They are led by their news media, their sports team, their rabbi, their priest, their parent, their boss. Most people don't go through the process of thinking for themselves what they actually feel. And a lot of you, a lot of me listening to this, okay, well, I do. Well, you really don't. Really push back and figure out what you think of on your own. The statistics say 99% of us just follow. If you just follow and you follow the wrong thing right now, you could die. So you have to lead on your own, see where you are, and make your own assessment about how safe you're going to be in light of a dangerous disease. So we have to be leaders at our own level, make our own safety steps, decide if we're going to wear masks or not, decide how much we're going to hang out with people in a safe or unsafe manner. We have to lead our families, lead our businesses. We have to fill that leadership vacuum ourselves. And that leadership, if we all try to lead with the other in mind, if we all try to lead with soft eyes and an open heart, then this could become a uniting moment, right? It's a little, you know, maybe a little hard. I mean, I don't know why it's hard, but we ought to aim for that. So has anyone done that? Well, yes. In the era of COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, the global scientific community has actually come together like that. They've all put aside, in large ways, they put aside patent disputes, they put aside profit disputes, and there is unbelievable international cooperation going on in the global scientific community right now. So they've given us an example of leading other-focused, leading soft eyes, leading with cooperation with others, and so have healthcare workers. Not just that they're putting the really obvious example of all the healthcare workers who go to work. Those are human beings who went to work without proper masks, without proper PPE, put their lives on line to die for us. They truly are the best of us. And they went out and showed that they were leading for us. And hundreds of them died because they decided to show up for work and do this. That's the sad fact, right? And the other group that's the scientific community and now the healthcare community both have done this. They both have led cooperatively and filled the leadership vacuum. So as much as any of us can learn from that, the better we'll be.
So RP, I have three left. Two of them are really short. I'll do one, which is, you know, specific to my trip and, do whatever you want on that next one. I know we've got a bit of a time crunch, but communities for humans will return and communities for consumers will fade. This is an observation I've been making for some time because I drive across the country and travel around the country a lot. And I drove across the country this past summer. What I mean by that is, you know, I like blue highways. Blue highways are the small old highways that connect these places. And these roads basically were designed when they were built to connect the town center, to the university, to Churchill Downs. I mean, you see it all when you go on Blue Highways. And the towns, you know, started falling apart some time ago. If you look at Dubuque, Iowa, or different places that you see. And they were replaced by these, you know, drive-throughs, right? It's the gas station, the convenience store. You guys all know it. You've all seen it 100 times. Well, those are starting to unwind too. The internet has impacted them. And what's happening is you're seeing the, you know, the flowers are starting to bloom in some of these, you know, in Vicksburg, in, you know, in Florence, where the town itself starts to come back to life. And what's nice about those towns, they were built for people. There's a park, you know, the town square, there's a church. There's a you know, it might be a government building, there might be a library, those kinds of things. The modern community has been built for cars, built for consumers. It's a consumer car thing. They're very unattractive and they're actually starting to go away a little bit. It makes me feel hopeful. I'm flashing forward. I'm imagining us with electric cars that we plug into our houses, and our purpose for community changes and will rise in a way that's really interesting and useful. But in the end, what we saw in Tupelo last night, which is a beautiful community, and it seems to be coming alive. It was the place for community to happen. And I think that's just such a piece that we've kind of taken apart over time, and maybe we're rebuilding it. There's hope in that. I can't directly attribute science to that, but there's hope in that.
Say the sentence again: communities for people will increase, communities for consumers will recede. Is that what it was?
Consumers for humans will return, and communities for consumers will fade. Modern communities are for consumers, not for humans.
There's I've had two really fascinating conversations during this pandemic with a European leader from a group called Therma, a brilliant guy, and then a named Mikolai's becoming a dear friend, and he's trying to redesign communities to be neighborhood focused. Well, these, and then the guy named Joe Lewis, who owns a big piece of land in Florida called Lake Nona. So these two really successful business people, both independently, are trying to figure out how to create communities that are more about neighborhoods, more about walking, more about families, yeah, more about neighborhood, word that you make so real, versus consumerism and cars. So there's real people thinking about these things kind of all of a sudden. That's a new one. That's not on my list. The closest one would be one I think we've talked a lot about in this conversation, but we should put a point on it because I think it really matters. I think Stacy taught us this, right? And the way serve others to serve yourself seems like a huge lesson here, right? So while we may feel helpless or scared, we do feel helpless or scared. Remember, Stacy said when she feels helpless or scared, one road out for her is to get up and help someone else. Carrie Wood, similarly, like the huge impact that you can make in a community, and to some extent how selfish this is, right? To be other-centered and lead with love, again, Stacy, is a selfish and awesome act at the same time. And yeah. I'll to accelerate things, I'll mix it with one of my two big lessons I hope we learn. One I already mentioned and we discussed about, will we learn from Cassandra's? The other one is this, correlated to that. My hope, one of my dreams, and it came out of talking to a lot of the TNP fellows the other day, Tom, thank you for that opportunity. If I had to have an aspiration for part of what comes out of this, one is we listen to Cassandra's, we don't get walloped by catastrophes again, we listen to warnings, like an obvious, it's like, if you had to pick what RP would guess and want, that's the obvious one. Here's another one. For those people who are trying to get out and serve other people in any way now because of this pandemic, and maybe they hadn't previously, my hope is that we all learn the addictiveness of service, right? That like maybe we can create this habit of service through this crisis, that more and more people realize how self-fulfilling and how, again, selfish it is to serve. And we all can get if we all start getting the serotonin boost of service through this pandemic, that becomes a habit we carry forward on the way out of this. And that would be a hope of mine.
It's also just such a great act of learning. You know, it's hard not to listen in service. I mean, sometimes we all make that mistake, but it's, all right, I'm going to give you my last two at the same time. And they're, you know, sort of inarguable maybe. One is America is beautiful, beautiful place. And two, masks are a movement, a sign of love. There's something about seeing masks that makes me feel good. And it's ultimately, it's a self, you know, to your point, it's a selfless act to wear a mask. And I would put those two together. I mean, one of the things I say this a lot, I don't know what an ugly landscape looks like. As long as God made it, it's going to be beautiful. I'm being literal, like man can mess up a landscape, but God doesn't seem to. You know, it could be a forest, it could be a swamp, it could be a river, it could be a mountain, it could be a field, it could be whatever it is. It's amazing how beautiful. And our country just has such a wide variety of beautiful places. That's my 10.
No such thing as a bad landscape, but there's a great, it's kind of a Nordic quote, no such thing as bad weather, just bad gear.
Yeah, right, right.
So yeah, okay, I think I'm at my last one too, and it's pretty, we're gonna find a merger here at the end too, Tom. America is beautiful, you said. I said the United States needs to lead internationally too, through love, Pax Americana. We must use this as an opportunity to show the world the goodness, the love, and the strength of the United States. America needs to be the rising tide. America, the spirit, the illumination of what we've been forever, and we really evinced probably profoundly in 1942 when we entered World War II, that spirit of service and sacrifice and leading the rest of the world. And again, service is selfish, just like an individual serving in a community gives at least me a serotonin boost. Like I'm getting a fix when I help. When America helps, it's selfish for America too. We create a level playing field. We create an opportunity that's America benefits from. So you say America is beautiful. I certainly agree. And I say America should take that beauty and take our love and our greatness, and we need to share it internationally. So right now, the second floor of our house is on fire. It's not a time for us to go run out across the seas and help other people, it appears, but we can chew gum and walk at the same time. So I hope America can use this global crisis as a chance to help save lives in the US and overseas, but also to do a little bit to reclaim America's righteous place as a global leader and as a beacon of freedom and democracy and hope that we used to be, and we kind of lost that mantle, and here's a good chance for us to get that mantle back. And as I said, it's selfish. It's good for us. It's also good for the world. I strongly believe in that. So those are my 10 as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Bye, guys.